and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me, as per usual. Can you please introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Hazel Keedle, and I'm a lecturer of midwifery at the School of Nursing and Midwifery in Western Sydney University.
So what got you into midwifery?
Well, I kind of was destined to do that. My granny was a midwife.
Oh, nice.
And I'm from the UK originally, and I spent a lot of time with my granny. She was my dad's mum, and we just knew that she was a midwife. You know, even if she was retired, she was a midwife. And I used to walk around the little village. So she was a village midwife, a district midwife. And people would just come up and chat to her, you know, and there'd be these hushed little conversations, and I would try and listen in, and then they'd go. And it was like almost every, you know, 5 minutes someone would bump into her. And I'd say, how do you know these people, Granny? And she'd say, oh, I was their midwife, or I was their mother's midwife, or whatever. Like, there's always a midwifery link to them.
Yep.
And for me, growing up, a midwife was a very important woman in the community, because that's what she was. Mm. And she would always be getting phone calls. Like, we'd stay with her and she's always getting phone calls. Her close friends, she was widowed for many, many years. And so her close friends were people that she had been a midwife or a nurse with. And she did her nursing through the war and then did midwifery after that. And she had she was working in London during the war. So she really was exposed to a lot of interesting experiences and near misses as well. So, I very much idolised my granny, and I was really interested in the health side as well. So I joined the St John's Ambulance when I was a cadet, and, would teach first aid to people, and I just loved that whole kind of area. When I was 15, my granny said to me, I remember we were walking across the park with her dogs, and she said, look, you will be the midwife in the family, and you'll be the person I pass my buckle on to. And, I was probably in the middle of all of her grandkids age-wise, and there were lots of girls and boys but ahead of me. And she'd also had a daughter, but none of them had gone into nursing. And she just said that I would be that one. And I wasn't quite sure at the time, but looking back, I actually did everything she said. We didn't have the BMID, so I would, I did what she said. I did nursing, and then I did this area, and then I did that area. And she said, when the time is right, you'll get into midwifery, and then you'll never leave. And she was right, and she lived long enough for that to happen.
Brilliant.
She died in her 90s, and so she knew that I was a midwife, even though I moved over to Australia 20 years ago this year.
Wow.
I was very much in contact with her, and she knew what I did, and she was very, very proud. And then all of my uncles are on that side as well, are very invested in me being a midwife. One of my cousins did become a nurse, but after me, because she had her kids first. So I got the buckle before her, even though she's about 10 years older than me. And she's a nurse lecturer, but I'm the only midwife in the family. And she's right. Once I joined midwifery, I just never left. And I got to the point in my nursing where I wanted more autonomy.
Yep.
And I was just drawn to women's and children's health, and I couldn't see another area of nursing that was really going to get that for me. So, I did my midwifery here in Australia. I did my nursing in England, but my midwifery here in Australia, and just love being a midwife. I can't imagine being anything else.
It's when you get that kind of familial mentoring that is done both officially but unofficially, and it's through the blood, that's just beautiful.
Yeah, and I think, looking back, we haven't got much of my granny's history, but I think there is even some midwifery that goes a bit further back as well, just from anecdotal stories that we've had. She was a formidable woman, and we would call her granny, but we knew she was a midwife, and that's what she was.
I think it brings up the importance that we have the technology now of recording our histories, of our elders, of our grandmothers, of all the women who've come before us, before they do go, because we then only have those anecdotal stories, which are great, but we have the technology that when we go and speak to someone now, it's like, can I record our conversation? Tell me about what you remember.
Absolutely. Because I picked my uncle's brain. My uncle, who was the eldest, she actually went and did midwifery when he was like in his late teens. So he remembers it.
Yeah.
And she had to leave the home to go and do that. And she actually went to East London to where they did call the midwife. And in that area around the Tilbury Docks, and did her pupil midwifery training there, and then had to come back. And she would have had, you know, four kids at home, plus quite a few stepkids too, and was leaving them with like neighbours so that she could go and do her training. Like, it was just magnificent. But I do pick his brain. I do actually have to sit him down and record. So that's prompted me. I need to do that, because he's got the one with the longest memories of her experiences.
Definitely record. But also that kind of is like a remembrance of another time where we had that. We know the world is a village. We know that the kind of like society we have as a village. But it shows that that was how she got through, was through that village of the neighbours that did look after each other and, pop the kids off. I'll pop my head in every now and then, see if they're kind of like still alive type thing. But you did that. You wouldn't – it's harder to do that now. It's like I'm in amazement of students who come in that have got any kids really. But I've got 3, 4, 5, 6 kids. We've had – I think the most we've had is one woman who had 7 kids. And time management was beautiful. But – that she had to, they use their support services, and some of them don't have support services to go through.
And I know I moved over here, and then I had a family while I was here. All my family were in the UK, except for the one that I've created here. And I became, like my granny did, which was really quite strange, I became a stepmom to 3 kids, and we then had 2 more. So we had 5 kids in the house full time. And just not to have your family around, to have that support. It was just so hard, you know, and I really do understand when our students come in. In fact, I was teaching first years in their first class yesterday, and we were looking at transferable skills, you know, the things that you're bringing. And then I'm saying to them, you know, those of you that are mothers, you know, you've got project management, you've got time management. Mm. If you've got children with special needs, you've got advocacy.
Yep.
All those extra things that you actually bring. But it is amazing that women can do that, and in the past that women were able to do that in a situation where actually even it wasn't formalised daycare or formalised services either.
But also brings in the importance of why the village knew your gran.
Yeah.
Because if people didn't have that support, the importance of the midwife being that support person, especially when it was continuity. Yeah.
Yes, and they knew that she was coming back. So they knew that she was coming back to their little village. To be the midwife, because she was the district nurse in that village and was then going to be the district midwife. So, there was that support there, and a lot of support from professionals that she worked with as well, like GPs. And she'd be called for almost any reason to go and do stuff, either nursing or midwifery, but mainly midwifery.
Cool. So when you graduated, you finished your training. I keep calling it training and I shouldn't. It's education. I'm trying to get out of the old mindset. You finished your education. So then where did you work afterwards?
So I did my training at Nepean Hospital in the Sydney's West, right at the foot of the Blue Mountains. I lived in the Blue Mountains.
Gorgeous place.
Yeah. During my training, I met my now husband. That was right. Let me turn that in. That was right at the end of my year. So I did the graduate diploma. And I wanted to work in low risk because I knew that really community midwifery, which isn't really a thing over here, but home birth midwifery and low risk midwifery is what I wanted. And we have a local hospital that is a low risk hospital, but they never took new grads. But because they actually, I worked there in children's ward because I had come from nursing and had a lot of children's nursing background. So they were able to kind of take me on because the manager is women's and children's health. So like she was like, sure, we'll take you on and we'll say you're kind of doing the nursing side, but actually I'll quickly just get you into midwifery. So I was very lucky that I got to work in a low-risk unit with some amazing midwives who were apprehensive about having a new grad there. But they didn't really have students there, but now they do. They actually have our students from Western up there, and they're much more open to new grads now. But Yeah, it was an amazing time because it was a low-risk unit. There weren't any registrars. There were only consultants, and they were on call. And I got to see so much. I remember in my first month or two having a woman asking for a physiological third stage, and I had never seen that. I knew about it, but I'd never been there because the hospital I'd come from was a tertiary hospital, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And we had two women birth. We only had two birthing rooms, and there was a woman in each room, and there's only two midwives on, so we kind of split between the two. And I said to the other midwife, who was a beautiful, gentle midwife who really inspired me, called Sally, and I said to her, well, how do I do that? Like, how do I do a physiological third stage? And she goes, you do nothing. I said, but how do I do that? So this real learning of how to sit on your hands and how to watch normal and how to appreciate it. And in the Blue Mountains, we have a very alternative community up here. So women would often ask for these things that were a little bit different. And, you know, so I got to see lotus births and, you know, I got to see physiological third stages. We got to see transfers in from home births. We got to build those relationships with home birth midwives. And it was a very difficult time. We had a lot of managerial issues and a high turnover of our managers and senior manager issues. There was problems there because of it. We had a no water birth policy, and there was a lot of no VBACs. And so there was a lot of restrictions for women in the area. We had closures, we had rallies. It was all during the time of, you know, 2010, getting the new maternity reforms out there. And so I realized that, you know, I kind of was a bit of a square peg in a round hole in a hospital, even a low risk one, that I wanted to re-explore home birth.
Yeah.
And I was part of the home birthing community. I was also having my first baby in my first year out and then my second baby in my second year out.
Oh, nice and sequential.
Yeah, they're only 13 months apart. And that started an opening up. They're both two planned home births, which neither of them were home births because they were transfers in. And I was exposed to the home birthing community and realizing that's something that I really wanted experience in. I did get a phone call once by a doula who I knew very well. She would be my doula. And she said, look, this woman is planning a VBAC, wants to birth at home. And there's a doctor at the hospital who says, as long as she births on a Friday or the weekend that he's on call, he'd approve it.
Oh, okay.
And she's now realizing at 36 weeks that maybe she wants to have a home birth, but there's no one available.
Mm.
And I remember being sick as a dog. I remember being so sick on the lounge. And she rang me and we were on the phone for a really long time. And I said, look, I'll come and visit you on the Monday. I'm on an early shift. I'll come and visit you afterwards and, you know, let's go from there. And she would be 37 weeks. Well, as I was walking to the car after my early shift, I got the phone call saying from her, I think I'm in labour. Will you still come?
Oh, wow.
So there was myself, there was a midwife colleague, a good friend of mine that came along, and then the doula who was probably the most experienced home birther out of all of us, to be honest.
Yep.
And she was an amazing doula. And I was there. I was breastfeeding my baby while I was there. And it was an eye-opener. And she had this home birth and it was amazing. And I was, at that point, I knew I was just hooked.
Yep.
So I looked into being a home birth midwife. I was the first one in the mountains to get the eligibility.
Nice.
Which is now endorsement.
Yep.
And from then onwards, I always did home birth midwifery, as well as other things that I did, because I did move out west and I did a few things out in the central west. So that was always a part of it until very recently.
Cool. So then how did you get into research? What was the spark that kind of got you involved in research that ended up leading to a PhD pathway?
Well, at 4 o'clock on the 20th of October 2008, I pushed my baby out of my vagina after 13 months beforehand having a cesarean.
Yep.
And I fought during labour. I was a transfer in because unfortunately my team were all with someone else.
Yep.
So I didn't have my team and I didn't feel confident. I knew I'm too analytical that I wouldn't be able to relax and have a VBAC at home with all the knowledge that I had and not be able to give that to somebody else.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't do, which I think is something, you know, when you're a midwife, you all women need to surrender during labour, but I think as a midwife with all that knowledge, you need to surrender even more. And I didn't have anyone to surrender to.
Yeah.
So I did transfer. I had to go. I couldn't go to my local hospital. I had to transfer down, down the mountain. And it was a challenging labor. Mm-hmm. I was told I was too quiet. I was told I was too loud. I was told I had to stay on the bed. I was told I wasn't allowed in the shower. And then a lot of the time I was abandoned, which was good because I could press pause on the CTG, unplug myself and go to the shower for a little while and then come back in and plug myself back in.
Oh, no.
And press start. And sometimes they look at the CTG and I'm sure they're looking like, what? Who did we get there? But I, you know, like I had to manipulate the system. And yep. I needed a woman with me to support me. And the midwife they allocated to me really wasn't providing any yep. of that support. And I was getting a lot of bullying from the registrar on duty. So I did manage to get someone I worked with. She was given permission to leave her shift early up at Katoomba to come down to me. And, you know, she walked in. And I think as soon as I saw her, I just had this verbal diarrhea. I was like, what if I can't do this? I just went straight into transition. I kicked my husband out the room while I was chatting to her. And I had this verbal diarrhea. And she was just like, you know, if I can have birth a baby, you're the strongest woman I know. So if I can do this, you can do this. And I was like, yep. Yeah, you're right. Just, you know, I know when women are in labor, it doesn't matter if you're really, really blunt, but I was pretty blunt.
Yeah.
And I just started pushing.
Yeah.
And she went and got me the birthing stool. And I pushed and they came in and they were like, she needs to get on the bed right now. They told me I was going to go for cesarean at 4 o'clock.
Oh.
I said, she needs to get on the bed right now. And I was on the birthing stool. My husband's a big man. He's sitting behind me, holding yep. me. And I went, don't you let go. And so the two midwives either side trying to physically lift me off the birthing stool. And he's holding on to me. There's no way they would be able to. And then
but since the whole imagery of that is just so against everything.
It's crazy. They just weren't believing I could do it. And yet I could feel it was bum, 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 vagina. Like I could yeah. feel her head come down. And once they saw head, like, you know, it was like a mass exodus except for the two midwives who need to be in the room. The doctors were like, oh, fine, okay, and just stormed out. And I birthed her through my vagina and I just felt amazing. And I wondered, really, it left me with a couple of questions. One, do other women feel this amazing after having a baby?
Yep. Yep.
And two, if it was so hard for me, and they knew me, okay, they may have known me as the renegade midwife, but they knew me and I had to battle, how could any woman
yep.
succeed to have a VBAC in the hospital system? I just didn't know how they could. So about a year or so afterwards, I met Hannah Darlin at a community forum. She'd come up to run this community forum to find out what was going on in the mountains. I shared my story at that forum, and which was pretty brave since I was actually a midwife at the hospital that they were investigating. But that was me. I shared my story. She came up to me and said, you need to research this. Like, I'd love you to come and do a project with me. And of course, I had 5 kids under the age of 10 at that point, so and 2 very young babies. So I waited in about another year. I got the odd email from Hannah during that time. And then I just thought, yeah, you're right. I want to know a bit about this. I want to know more. So I got in contact. I started my master's honours project, which was exploring women's experiences of having a VBAC at home. I published that. And I got addicted to research. I just loved it. I just loved the impact that you could have, but just the whole process. I'd always been told I was kind of the stupid one in my family. In school in the UK, you have this 11 or 12 plus, which tells you which kind of high school you're going to go yep. to. All of my family members passed, except for me. And so I got to go to the dodgy comprehensive. Whereas others got to go to the grammar schools, and my brother got to go to the grammar school, single-sex grammar school. And, you know, I think it was just that I've now found out my daughter has ADHD, she has autism as well, and I can see a lot of that ADHD in me, how I didn't do very well in school until I got stuff I was interested in. And I think this kind of midwifery was that, you know, and research was that. This was a topic I was very passionate about. And suddenly I could then excel and I could do these things that I never thought that I could do. And so with the support of three of the most amazing supervisors I could have ever had, which was Professor Hannah Darling, Associate Professor Elaine Burns, and Professor Virginia Schmid.
Yeah,
they became my supervisors and my mentors and just filled me with so much confidence that I could do these things. So even when my master's thesis was being examined, I was already applying for a scholarship to do my PhD. And they're like, are you sure you don't want to wait for 6 months? I'm like, no, I'm on a roll. I'm just going to keep on going. And I wanted to explore all women's experiences of planning to be back in Australia, and not just those planning it at home. And I wanted to do it in as innovative way as I could. And I told my supervisors, you're not leaving, like, you're the same three.
Yep.
And then about a year or 18 months into my PhD, when I was doing that full time, I was living out in the Central West. I did say to Hannah one night, you know, if a position came up, I actually think academia is something I'd really like to do. At the time, I was still being a private midwife in the Central West, the only one in that entire area at the time, doing lots of travel.
Wow.
I had set up a women's group out there called the Better Birth Group. And we used to meet all the time. Like, I did some really awesome stuff there, but I could really see academia pulling me in. And I love public speaking. I love teaching. So a position came up and I moved my entire family back from the Central West back to the Blue Mountains. And I started working 5 years ago now this year at Western Sydney Uni as a lecturer. And I just love it. Absolutely love it.
There's something about, I mean, as Zane, we're both in the time of the semester where we've got first year starting. For us, it's week two of semester. And it is those faces that are so full of excitement. And it's hard not to crush their kind of like fantasies of what the career and what the profession is like. But you've got to sit there and go, well, we need to give you some reality as well as some kind of like dreams and fantasies. And you sit there and go, so who remembers their midwife? And most of them will go, yep, I remember them. I remember she was shit, and that's why I remember her.
Yeah.
But then I had another one who was beautiful, so I could see the difference of it. Yeah. It's a powerful position to be in.
Absolutely. I had a beautiful session yesterday, which was the first session it's our first week this week.
Yep.
And I actually missed the Monday group because of flooding. I was driving down through the mountains and it was flooded, so I had to drive home and do it on Zoom. They're all sitting in the classroom, bless them, and I'm like on their laptops. It was very weird. But the next day it was fine and I was able to teach that one. And I do really actually like teaching that first theory subject in first semester. I'm also the academic program advisor, so if they have any issues, they come to me about the course. And so and I really see that role as an extension of my midwifery role, because I'm just being a midwife to the future midwives, and it's a longer gestation,
mm-hmm.
like 3 years and maybe more if it's taken them longer to do the course. And, you know, my journey is to try and support and advocate and educate during that entire time. So I take on that role very naturally. But then to get that inspiration, they had a module on history of midwifery, and we were discussing it because I'd done it online, and then we were discussing it. And it was really beautiful because, you know, some of them were saying it's really helped them realize that they are part of a very, very long line.
Oh, yeah.
And how important that role is. Like, it really boosted them up at the beginning. It's not just like, oh, I've kind of thought about midwifery. I'm interested, but I don't really know. Should I be here? Do I deserve to be here? And our courses are hard to get on. So, you know, when they're sitting there and you tell them how many people applied, how many people we interviewed, how many people got spots, they're like, oh. But I kind of like that, because then I say, actually, you deserve to be here. Every single one of you right now got through all of that and are here, and you deserve to be here. But now let's look at midwifery and where you sit in that, and look at this amazing role and all these amazing midwives that came before you and the history of that and how it's connected internationally. And you could just see some of these minds just getting blown and going, wow, I'm part of this really important profession. And I'm like, you are. You will laugh. You will feel joy. You will feel amazement. You will cry. Mm-hmm. You will feel sadness. You will feel despondent. You're going to feel all of the emotions, and that's just within your training.
Right? Exactly.
And then you get out there and you feel that even more. So, it's a very honourable job to have. I do sometimes think clinical midwives might think, oh, well, you're not practicing clinically, so you know, you should be. But I did 20 years of working working clinically as a nurse and then as a midwife, and in all different models of care. I've worked in Aboriginal health, I've worked in tertiary hospitals, I've worked in smaller hospitals, I've worked in MGP, and I've worked in home birth midwifery. I crammed a lot into that time.
Mm.
I've been lucky enough to be with a woman who birthed on country twice.
Oh, nice.
And I was her midwife for that. So I've done a lot in that time. And now I did try and keep home birth midwifery going while I was working. And like you just can't keep all the balls in the air.
No.
And sometimes you have to choose which ones to keep. And you know, academia now and being a lecturer and going onwards with that is where I really see the power, and doing research is where I really see my future. And I'm proud of that. And I don't want us midwifery academics either to not feel proud of the choices we've made, because we are shaping those future midwives. And it's our experience and our knowledge and our passion for midwifery that does that. So,
and it's
reflected,
I think, when you look at the, so for the International Day of Midwife, the ICM put out that it's 100 years of progress is the theme for this year. And with in Australia itself, with the ACMs, the Australian College of Midwives, they've put out the history project.
Well, I love that history project.
I've grabbed amazing. That as part of my teaching as well.
Yeah, absolutely, I have.
And that's what I'm saying. It's that ability to now use technology and talk to the elders while they're still kind of around about the changes that they have seen and kind of gone through. And I keep mentioning the State of Midwifery report, that in there it says, yes, we need the clinical, but we also need the governance, we need the educators, we need the researchers, because we all work together. And by all of us working together, we're improving what we do. We're improving the outcomes for women. But you can't do evidence-based practice without somebody actually finding the evidence.
Doing the evidence, yeah.
And then we can't have the future know about evidence-based practice unless you've got the educators to actually showcase it. So, but on Twitter, it's interesting. There's always the argument that you're not a real midwife unless you're still hands-on with a birth. And it gets tiring to see that. But you sit there and kind of go, you know what, you do you, I'll do me, and we'll just keep improving the system together.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Kind of looking at the process of going from your master's straight into your PhD, what were the surprising results from your master's?
I think that not all women had chosen to have a birth at home from the very beginning. It wasn't as if they were absolutely committed to having home birth. What happened is that women had had their cesarean, they knew about the cascade of intervention, suddenly very knowledgeable about what worked and what didn't work, and then would come to the hospital and say, well, I want to have a VBAC, but, you know, I don't want to be induced, or I don't want to have a CTG on, or I want to be able to move around, or I want to be able to use the water. And they just got no's every time.
Mm.
No, you cannot do that. No, you can't go past 40 weeks. No, you can't have intermittent monitoring. No, you cannot use the bath. And all these no's really just pushed these women into a corner who then had to make a decision of it's either the hospital's way or the highway and what else is out there. And because we do have a technological enabled community now, women were able to go online and read other people's stories and actually realize there were midwives out there that practiced privately and actually started ringing around some of these midwives. And instead of the reaction of no, they would get the reaction of yes, I'll support you. And yes, I believe you can do this.
Yeah.
And so it's a completely opposite reaction that they had received. And then all of a sudden they're getting this continuity of care, gold standard care, women that believe that they can do it and actually are building up their confidence, and then they actually then do it.
Mm.
And they have a VBAC at home. And I asked every single woman in the interviews, because they were all interviews, I said, how did you feel about your VBAC at home? And they may have shared their traumatic story with me about the previous one. And then you would see them just take this big breath in, and then it would be, I felt powerful.
Yeah.
I felt healed. I felt amazing. And I actually captured, I actually made a little sound bite of all their reactions. I went back to ethics and to the woman and said, can I use the sound bite? And at the end of my presentations, I would play that.
Yeah.
And you would just hear, I just put all of their voices together on just that one reaction of how did you feel after you'll be back at home? And you would just get people in the audience sobbing.
Was that was part of your, you did a presentation at ACM in 2019.
Yeah, I didn't have the recording for that one. No, I
that
didn't.
Presentation, I was there. And that presentation still had me kind of like, I think I remember I came up to you and said, that was just amazing. Because it was, yeah, just the quotes that you used in that presentation alone without hearing it was still very visceral.
Yeah, and I really should pull out that recording and start putting it back in some other presentations because it's because I moved on to my PhD stuff. I was obviously reporting on my PhD data, but that was really... a few things that happened from that is one, actually doing something a little bit different, which is creating a soundbite and then using that. And I like to always push the boundaries and think of crazy ideas and then just try them out unless I'm stopped. And I'm often not. And so really, I think from that master's, I got that sense of empowerment. And it answered one of my questions. After I'd pushed my baby out of my vagina, I felt powerful and I wanted to know if other women felt that, and that got answered.
Yeah.
That one was answered. Tick that box. Yes, other women felt like this as well, and particularly in the home birth arena because they were not treated as pariahs. They weren't stigmatized. They were actually treated like goddesses.
Mm.
And another thing that came out of that was some women had to transfer in post-birth. They may have had a third degree tear. They may have had a PPH. There may have been a problem with the baby. And clinicians in hospitals often see that as a failed home birth.
Yep.
Like, oh, she had a failed home birth. She had to come here. Actually, none of the women said that.
Yeah.
They said, well, I had to go in. Yeah, I had to go and have surgery because, you know, I had a third or fourth degree tear. And yes, I had to go and be sewn up. But that was just a blip.
Yep.
On my entire experience, I still went home really quickly. My midwife was there. We went home and I still felt absolutely amazing. And that was just a blip on the experience. I still pushed my baby out of my vagina and I did that at home. And that was very interesting because I don't think that's how, clinicians, especially midwives and doctors in hospitals, really think that. They would just see that as a failed experience.
And we're still equating, when you look at the safety, it all comes down to live birth, death babies. You've got equal chances. We know that the research shows kind of basically equal chances. But we're not looking at the more tangible measurements, which is kind of the morbidities or the women's feelings or, that kind of aspect of it. We need to change what we're using as end markers.
Yeah, absolutely. For measurement. So, just because this woman had a third degree tear and had to get me sutured up in theatres, that didn't stop her having her next VBAC at home either.
Yeah.
And I know that she had another VBAC at home. The other thing that I got from that was there was an onward journey.
Yeah.
So having a VBAC, pushing that baby out of your vagina after having cesarean was not the full stop. In fact, it was just a comma because there became so much more afterwards.
Yeah.
Many of the women became doulas. Or they became midwives, or they were just the sounding board in their community of women that were maybe suggesting intervention was better than it is. And they would just be a sounding board, or they would volunteer their time on social media support groups and be there to support other women along. It was never a full stop. It was never the end of the journey. It was just the beginning of a journey of advocacy. And that was something that I found really inspiring. It was actually one of the themes called The Onward Journey. Mm. And I could see that in myself because my onward journey was to do VBAC research and be a voice for VBAC. And it wasn't just me, though. It was other women would do this too. And that was really important. So then my next question that I had after I'd had my VBAC was, how do women birth? How do any other women birth the baby in the hospital?
Yep.
And that's what I wanted to find out with my PhD.
Yep. So how did that process then kind of develop? So you continued with the interviews?
So no, I then, you know, because I like to think outside the box, I then came up with a crazy idea of what I want to know is when women are during the pregnancy, they're planning a VBAC, and they're going to see their midwife or doctor, and then they come home, and you know you have that time where you reflect in your head. You know, it's kind of a bit of an oh shit moment. It's like, oh shit, why didn't I say that? Why was I like a stunned rabbit in the headlights? Like, why didn't I say all those things I wanted to do? Or why did they say that? Why did they mention that? Why did they give me that risk factor? Like that moment when you're thinking, I wanted to somehow get myself into the woman's head. Now, we don't quite have those implants yet where I could do that. So I had to think of another way. And so I thought of an idea of designing an app where women could record their experiences. They could come home, they could record their experiences, and then that would get sent straight to me as the researcher. And so it was like a journaling app. And I came up with the idea. My supervisors were like, oh, this kind of sounds interesting, Hazel. And I then, I'll be very grateful to the ACM. I did get part of the inaugural Pat Brody scholarship, research scholarship, to be able to get the app developed. And that was a journey all on its own. I've learned way too more than I ever thought I needed to know about IT and app development. And it's an ongoing process, I must say, even today. And it worked. I ended up with 13 women doing this journey, and I had over 52 recordings. Like, women, they did this. Like, that just still, that blows me away to the day that women actually were brave enough to come on and actually just share their stories. Like, they were amazing women. And those stories, God, they had me in tears. You know, I was frustrated. I was conflicted as a researcher on how much I should then intervene or not. The stories that were shared, and they were all addressed to me. It was like, hi, Hazel, I'm now, you know, I'm now blah, 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 weeks now, and this is what I experienced. And these women developed a relationship with me through this app. And then I got to interview them after they had their baby, which was like going to visit an old friend. It was a bit like internet dating, you know. Like, I don't know if you've ever done that. I met my husband through internet dating.
I know lots who have,
And you kind of build up this relationship online, but you don't know if there's going to be any chemistry. And when you meet them, and it's a long time since I've done that. We've been married 15 years now. But, you know, when you meet them, you're like, oh, is there chemistry? Is there not? Like, it's a bit strange. So I turn up to these women's homes, and they'd open the door and it'd be like, oh, hi, Hazel. Oh, hi. But very quickly we would get over that. And they would just share their story of their birth with me. And it also meant that I could catch up on things that maybe they alluded to in the recording, but then didn't come up in the interview. And that would have been data that would have just been lost. But I was actually able to pinpoint it and say, so at 36 weeks, you mentioned this in your recording, because I would read all the transcripts before I turned up and make notes on things I wanted to find out about. And they said, oh, yeah, that's right. Well, I found this out, and then I realized I couldn't do this, or this is what happened there. And I'm like, oh, wow, thank you. I've got that information now. So that was fascinating. And I did a narrative analysis on that, which I hadn't done before, which was basically keeping all the stories together. So each woman's story was all of their all their recordings and their interview. And then I compared each of those to each other. I would find out what are the common threads, What are the different threads, like which ones are a comparison with each other. And it was an amazing process, because I did do a thematic analysis first and it just didn't work. You just could not put all of this in one big pot and stir it up and come out with something. It just didn't work with these really rich stories. So this narrative analysis worked. I had all these comparisons. And what I realized through that process was that there were just these four factors. And you could either be high on that factor or low on that factor. And if you were high on that factor overall across all four, you felt, well, I say resolved, because that's because there were some women that had a cesarean, but they could still feel resolved. But you could also put in there felt healed, amazing, powerful. So positive. But at the bottom, there were these negative feelings. And that could also be whether or not they had a VBAC or a repeat cesarean. And I had half and half.
Okay.
And one woman that had insisted forceps in theatre.
Oh.
And then it split half and half. And, you know, then I theoretically scored them on all of the from the analysis, and would then see that they would either score, you know, they would either feel resolved or feel disappointed. And that I then tested in a national survey. So those four factors, which were having control, having confidence, having a relationship with your healthcare provider, and having an active labour, those four factors I then tested in a national VBAC survey. And I had, you know, questions pertaining to those areas in the survey, yeah. as well as some validated tools like the Mothers on Decision Making, Mothers on Respect yeah. Index that come from Canada. Because then I got a larger cohort of, you know what, I've done another survey since then. I've done quite a few surveys since then. Drumming in my numbers. But I think I had about 500 women that had a previous cesarean and then another couple of hundred women who were planning a cesarean. So I had two right. arms to the survey.
Yeah.
And so then I analysed that, and what I was realising through that analysis, which I taught myself SPSS to do, that thankfully had someone I could check that with so I didn't make mistakes. What we found there was that the model of care impacted that greatly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we then did this really interesting data modelling, which my husband, who now is a research assistant with us, but this was his introduction to our research projects. He comes from an environmental management mm-hmm. background, and they do a lot of climate change modelling. And I was saying to him, look, I can see all these numbers, but I just visually can't see the difference between fragmented care, continuity of care with a doctor, and continuity of care with a midwife. I can't visualize it. I'm assuming it's like these two are really close and that one's really low, but I just can't visualize it. So he used his modeling to come up with these amazing graphs that really showed you each of the different factors. We chose things for each of the different factors and then plotted them on this graph so you could see exactly where it lay
mm-hmm.
across those different models of care. And every time, continuity of care with a midwife scored higher.
Yep.
So women felt more in control. They had more confidence. They felt more confidence in their healthcare provider. They had a better relationship based on trust and equity and support. And they were far more likely to be active in labour, although not quite as much as we would have liked that to be. So they're more likely to have a water birth or water immersion during labour or to be upright. But still, those numbers were not great when it comes to active labour and birth. We've got a lot to work on in that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what my big models of care paper was actually comparing that and really showing that women want and really need continuity of care with a midwife when they're planning a VBAC. I couldn't tell you whether there were higher rates with women with midwives because it was a self-selected survey, you know, but we were looking at the overall experience, which, like you were saying earlier, Liz, like, you know, we need to kind of look at it. It's not just about the outcome that's important. Yeah. And that's one of the key things that came out of my PhD for me. I went into my PhD thinking it's all about pushing your baby out of your vagina.
Yep.
It's all about getting that feedback. But then what I came out from the end of the PhD, that is still really, really important. But actually, women can have a repeat cesarean and feel resolved if they still felt in control, if they still had confidence, if they still had a trusted and respected relationship, and if they had the opportunity to be as active as they could in labour.
Yeah.
And then if they then make that decision that, you know, I'm going to have to go for a cesarean, that's what I'm going to do, then they can still feel amazing after that as well.
And I think that they're the beautiful kind of consolidation of the keys, that we know we want more continuity of care, midwifery continuity of care models. We know we need more midwifery group practice models. Like, we know that. The evidence has been there for kind of 20 years, but we're still fighting for it. It's slowly improving. The workforce numbers that kind of came out the end of last year showed that overall we're about 15% midwifery group practice. South Australia and Queensland are leading it kind of in the 20s. Some states have got kind of doesn't even hit the top three models of care. But so many much more in the private setting or the public setting and the private setting for some. And the importance of, and this is where I think education plays that key role, both undergraduate education, but also getting into the professional in-servicing and the updating, is we can make changes in the system if we keep remembering those kind of four things. Mm-hmm. And if we, and it's, I hate the word allow because allow is so patriarchal.
Yeah.
But if we are there, if we believe in ourselves that we can enable the women to have the control, to sit there and go, this is what's happening. But once again, it all comes back to antenatal education as well and setting up those stepping stones. That kind of works within almost every aspect of midwifery care.
Absolutely. And I was asked by ACM to write an education module for midwives based on my PhD findings. And that was quite nice, actually, because it made me flip it then, because, you know, this had all my research had been about the woman's experience. And even now with the BEST survey, it's about the woman's experience. But then to try and flip it and think, well, what is it that I want midwives to know?
Yeah.
What is it that is important? And I actually challenged them in that module to consider continuity of care.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not going to use it as a dirty word. Like, I'm not going to apologize for it. If I had a dream, it would be that every midwife at some point in their career experienced continuity of care.
Yeah.
And were able to give that, because I think through that grows that true advocacy and that true relationship with women. And I've experienced continuity of care through MGP, through Aboriginal health, and also as a private midwife. It doesn't mean I think all women, all midwives should do that all the time. But even if there were secondment opportunities, you experience that for a while and realise that maybe the on-call isn't quite as scary at times and that you can leave it. And then maybe come back to it at other times. It needs to be a bit more fluid. It shouldn't be an us or them. They're the MGP midwives and we're the hardworking core midwives and we don't see them around, so obviously they're not working that hard. I've been there too. I've seen that attitude. But it should be more of a sharing of this is a really important model.
Yeah.
Everyone should experience that. And so I thought, what the hell? Like, they're giving me free rein to write this. I'm just going to do it. They had opportunities to review it. They didn't change anything. So in that module, I actually interviewed an MGP midwife because I thought, I need one that's current. You know, they're going to look at me and go, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's not done birth for like 1 year or something. but I thought, well, let's get an MGP midwife. And I did. I got a beautiful MGP midwife from Blacktown Hospital who I heard about through one of our graduates who was an MGP midwife there. And I said, well, I'd have to speak to someone in your team who really supports women planning a VBAC. And she goes, oh, we've got this amazing midwife. Speak to her. So I did a Zoom thing like this and we had a great chat and I turned that into a video that is actually part of that education. Yeah. So really hear what it is that MGP can bring to this.
Mm.
But I also then, you know, did have a lot of stuff in there that even if you weren't in a continuity of care, this is what you can do.
Exactly.
And I even, because I do have a book coming out this year and the artist who has done the front cover but also has done drawings in the book because it's for women, I've got permission from him to be able to put those in that module.
Oh, nice. So
it then also looks at positions that you could use. Like, this is stuff that midwives know, but I think they lose their confidence to do.
Mm.
So I was just trying to give permission back to say, come on, try this position out, get them on the ball, or, you know, this is what it looks like. And the drawings have CTG monitors on them.
Yep.
You know, I'm not trying to say throw out every policy because I know I've been at the other end of not following policy for the women's choice, and it's not always a comfortable space to be in.
Yeah.
So I don't want midwives to be in that uncomfortable space. But so I got these drawings with the CTGs on, and in the book that helps women think about what else they could do.
They can do, yeah. Because if they see it, they can believe it.
Yeah, and in the ACM module, it was all about actually, you know, get inspired by these and do that as well. So I think midwives can make that difference at any point. And I also have in that is a beautiful story, well, actually an interview with a woman who had a VBAC. And her onward journey is she is now a second-year student at my university.
Excellent.
And then I heard the other day, in the book I've got 15 stories of women at the end. And they share their photos and they share their birth stories. And I think it's really important because they've all got something a little bit different.
Yep.
It's VBAC plus a few other things, right? So it might be a breech birth or it might be a higher BMI because women really get stigmatized for that, especially if you're then planning a VBAC as well. Or it might be multiple births. I've got loads of different things in there that add it, even from women from colour, women of colour and from different parts of the world. And one of the stories I got was a breech VBAC, and I read it and I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. And she shared photos. And then I had to get permission from them when it went to the publishers just to make sure that they're happy with them sharing their stories, especially their photos.
Yep.
And she came back and she's now a first year student. And I'm like, oh, that's amazing. Like, this is so, there's actually now 3 student midwife stories in the book that were not planned, but it just shows their onward journey, that they all got inspired, and especially 2 of them were inspired by that VBAC experience to want to support more women to have that opportunity.
What was the one of the more unusual things that came out of your PhD that you weren't expecting, that took you by surprise, either a positive or negative?
Yeah, sure. So I think for me the big thing was about how what we would read on paper or in someone's notes would be felt so differently. So there was two women on my in the qualitative phase, which was at the app phase. And I interviewed them on the same day because I was traveling out west, and I had all these interviews. A lot of the interviews from other parts of the country had to be online, obviously, but the ones that were in New South Wales I could do face to face. And from someone who's worked in healthcare for such a long time, I could, from what the stories they told me, I could imagine that it basically looked the same in the notes or on, you know, e-maternity, whatever it was. It would kind of say the same thing. They planned a VBAC. They got to fully dilated. They had an emergency repeat cesarean.
Yep.
But the woman's experiences were at either end of the continuum. One woman was completely unsupported. She'd had continuity of care with a GP obstetrician who just didn't know her. Every time we'd be saying, oh, so you're having a cesarean. No, I want to plan the VBAC.
Mm.
And actually had a very active labour at home, and didn't really realise that she was in labour actually, and then thought, oh, I'm getting some pains, I probably should go to the hospital, and turned up and she was pretty much fully dilated, but was only given 20 minutes and said, oh, no, you're not progressing, we've got to go to theatres.
Oh, what?
And her partner hadn't even got there yet, because she didn't even realise that she was in active labour, that she kind of sent him to drop off the kids and go and get a coffee, and he turns up and he's like, well, where's she gone? And she had no support and no opportunity. And she felt like it was her fault.
Mm-hmm.
She blamed herself, like, I should have hired a doula, or I should have engaged a midwife, and maybe if I'd read more, maybe if I'd been more engaged. And there's nothing there that was that woman's fault.
Yep.
You know, she just was not believed or supported by the health, by the midwife and the doctor that came in on that day, and was in a system that just doesn't support VBAC.
Mm.
The other woman had had midwifery group practice, and she had been in hospital for pretty much the entirety of her labour. She had a doula as well. For the entirety of her labour, she did everything. Like, she swung from the chandeliers. Like, she did every single position she could. And she was in the shower. I think she may have used the bath. She was upright. And she was there for a long time. And then she was fully dilated. I think for 2 hours, she was fully dilated. And in the end said, I just know this baby's not descending. I can feel this baby's not descending. I want to go for a cesarean now. And she made that decision. On the paper, would look like the same thing. But she made that decision and she went. And when I interviewed her, yeah, there was a little bit of sadness. Oh, I didn't get that. But actually, I feel like I pretty much had my feedback. I just didn't push my baby that much.
Yep.
I just couldn't do that last little bit. And that's when I needed the support. And they couldn't do an assisted birth. It had to be a cesarean. That head just didn't come down. She goes, but I did absolutely everything in my power to have a vaginal birth. And she had advocated for herself and she'd had all the support. You know, she felt the disappointment from her doula, I think, you know, she's like, actually, I did everything I could. And I got to the point where I knew my body and I could feel that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
And that was really the when I reflected on that, to do one interview after the other, and I just had to pull over and just write like what my thoughts were,
yeah,
and my reflections on that. And that's when it started realizing that it wasn't just about the vagina.
Mm.
It was actually about how women felt,
yep,
and how women were supported and how involved they were in that decision making. So, that was quite a pivotal moment for me. And I think, I'm not sure if there were many other really big surprises. In the survey, I asked for birth position, and the most common birth position was laying flat on the bed with legs in stirrups.
That's surprises me.
But I can also tell you from the national survey that we've done for all women, in the best survey with over 8,000 responses, the most common position is lying flat on your back, legs in stirrups.
And that is heartbreaking on so many different levels.
Yeah.
So many different
levels. When I saw it with VBAC, I could rationalize that.
Yep.
You know, women are very medicalized and they really have to fight so hard to have their VBAC. And often it just comes at the end as, you know, I couldn't agree with it. No way could I agree with it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a birth like that for so long. But I could kind of understand how that happened. But for all women?
So what was
models of care?
So, and that's across ages as well, or is that kind of more towards the older mothers or that's
well, we haven't done any fancy statistics on it yet.
Right. Yep.
So can I tell you about the best?
Please do, because I can definitely want to hear, because the thing is, where do you go from now? And this is where you go from
yeah,
now.
Yeah, so I as soon as I left, as soon as I finished my PhD, I'd submitted it in the October-November time in 2020? Yeah, 2020, COVID. That's right, because it was COVID year, yeah. I wrote my thesis in COVID year. But I had done it by publication, so I did have four publications, and I've now got 5 publications from that PhD. One just came out recently, yes. Which actually analysed all the comments, which was called Coercion to Respect for Maternity Care, and that really looks at some of that coercive control that happens for women planning a VBAC. And I wrote that in my post my PhD year, so when my PhD was being examined. So I submitted it in the October, November. In the January, Hannah got approached by the producers of Birth Time.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, we'd love to do a survey alongside releasing this film.
Yeah.
But they approached her in the January and the film was being released in the February.
Yeah.
And January, you know, a lot of people take leave. I hadn't taken leave, but a lot of us academics do. And Hannah had. And she said no.
Yeah.
We just can't do that. And then she obviously mulled it over and then thought, well, Hazel's just finished her PhD. I wonder if anyone can, Hazel probably can.
Yeah.
So then she contacted me while she was on leave and we had a big chat about it. And I said, hell, why not? Let's do this. Like, this is a momentum. Let's get on the momentum. Women are going to want to share their stories after they've watched that movie. So I had less than a month to...
As you do.
Listen to ethics because the first ethics of the year was the end of January.
Yep.
I think I found out about it. Like the second week of January, maybe at a push. I had to drop everything else I was doing and design this survey. Now, Hannah and I have worked together on a lot of surveys. We've done the Birth and the Time of COVID survey, yep. And I'm kind of like the survey developer in that yep. program. So I've got my hands on a lot of survey stuff. So I could put a lot of stuff in. We didn't want it just to be us. We actually reached out to 10 consumer organisations and maternity organisations and said, partner with us. And so they got to check the survey first and get some come back to us. So they piloted it and came back to us and we changed it. We got it to ethics. I can't believe we still did it when I look back at it now. Got it to ethics for that first meeting of the year, which was the end of January. And that was the survey being complete, like not even just saying we'll send you the survey. That was the whole thing done. And we got it in and we got it back about a week after Birth Time had been released, which is pretty good when we think about how long it takes for ethics to come through. Obviously, you have minor alterations you have to do and all that kind of stuff. Those of you who don't know the ethics process, it's just a whole different ballgame.
But minor alterations are nothing. They don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Take that long.
Minor things. I'm like, woohoo.
Yeah, exactly.
So we got it through, and you know, we had organised with Birth Time to have little postcards made up, which they created.
Yep.
And I had the QR code on there and it was all good to go. In fact, I actually had to put an extra question on the landing page because people were QR coding it before we'd got the ethics. It's like, no, not yet. Come back. And we then did this big, big release. We had no idea how big this would be. We didn't know if we'd be able to pull it off even. But myself and Hannah just threw ourselves into this and we did it. We then applied for a partnership grant because obviously, some of the feedback from our maternity consumer organisations were, oh, it's only in English. And we're like, yeah, I know right now it is, but hey, let's raise some money and turn this into different languages.
Yep.
So we did. We went for a partnership grant with all of those maternity organisations, raised money. So we had PBB Media doing a GoFundMe page. We had each of the different organisations committing money. Mm-hmm. We had the amazing Canberra Mothercraft Society commit money. And we had to reach a minimum of, I think it was five, we had to reach a minimum of, I think, 2,500. That was all. Mm-hmm. So that our school would then match that.
Yep.
And I then went to a couple of companies. One of them came back, Kiara came back and said, sure, we'll give you some money. In fact, you can have our first inaugural research development fund.
Excellent.
And that actually pushed us above. So we actually ended up with much more than we originally allocated. Yep. And so we were able to translate it into seven other different languages.
Nice.
You know, in a creative way, I may say, because this is during COVID. And a lot of people don't have work. And yep. So I didn't actually just want to give a lot of money to a transcription company, which actually we wouldn't have been able to cover anyway, because when I did get those quotes back, even though we'd got a good grant, really
they're astronomical.
We just couldn't do that. So I then thought, well, I'm a feminist and I'm a feminist researcher and I want to give this back. And if there's any opportunity to give back to women, yep. I will. So I put it out there to communities and looked for women who were bilingual in the language that we wanted, who would actually do the translating for us.
Yep.
So we had women in the communities. We had students who, you know, got some extra money from it. We had women who, one woman I remember, who had been out of work because her work was in the tourism industry, and she was so excited to do this. To do this project to get some money. Like, I worked with all these different individuals, so I didn't work with a big company, and they did these translations, and we got the translations out there as well. We also had money for a poet, which this kind of blows my mind that we even kind of thought about this idea at those early times.
Yeah.
We got a poet, and we've actually got our next paper, our first paper from the best survey to come out is going to be on poetry inquiry, and actually has poems from the data.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to be publishing a book of poetry from the data created by the amazing poet Pixie Willow, who has her own book of poetry published.
The beautiful blending of art and science.
Oh, I know. Like, so it's been a bit of a crazy year last year to do it, get this done. But we released it in March. We closed it in December. We've got a research statistician looking at all the data, who just happens to be my husband as well. And so it's kind of fun. We get a lot of work done because we're here together. We're like, mom, get this work done. So we're getting a lot of data done in a short period of time. We ended up with 8,804 completed surveys, like valid
Lovely.
Surveys. That's the biggest birth experience survey that's been done. And I'm so honoured to all these women that did it.
So there was Australia only, or it was open internationally?
Australia only.
Because I remember seeing it and sharing it, and I was kind of thinking that it would be mind-blowing, but to have it internationally would just be...
Oh, that's coming, Liz.
I don't doubt that with you on board.
We've got it being done in Denmark.
Yep.
We've got it being done in the Netherlands. I think we've got some interest in Switzerland and hopefully New Zealand as well. And so the Danish one and the one from the Netherlands is pretty much complete.
Yep.
And we actually had a meeting this week, so they're almost good to go. We're just going to upload it onto the survey database now.
The Dutch one
excited.
Would be really interesting.
There's going to be some really interesting.
Especially and looking at the different models of care.
Yeah, and it's even been like looking at how do we translate some of that into there's not much change to the actual survey. It's just like, you know, looking at their models of care a bit different to ours or whatever. We've got that happening as well. We have our first paper was the Poetry Inquiry, which was a collaboration between myself and the poet, where she put in about seven poems and then she actually wrote reflective poems on the poems that she wrote.
Oh, wow.
That paper we've just had a conditional approval for. So watch out for that one. I'm so excited. And I think because it's not a data paper, I actually think a lot of our women who did the survey are going to find it quite impactful. But I do give a bit of a caveat. The whole thing, all the poems are on birth trauma.
Yeah.
So they're not an easy read.
No.
Like, even for myself, who's just read so much birth trauma over the years working in this space, I felt like I got punched in the chest when I read some of the poems. Like, she'd send me, it just takes it to another level. You read a quote, you get impacted. You read it in the poetic form, it's like, just someone's just hit you. Like, it just is amazing. So, and we actually got that feedback back from the editor of the journal saying, like, this is really impactful paper. We're really looking forward to publishing it. So that's coming out. The next one that comes out, I'll tell you what, Liz, I don't hold any, I don't go for the easy stuff at all. One of the questions we asked was, did you experience obstetric violence? And we put a definition in there. And 1 in 10 women said yes.
I'm surprised it's not higher, actually.
Well, I think it's not higher because people don't recognize it.
Yeah.
Because it's much higher for those that said birth trauma. And we're analyzing that data now. But I really felt that, you know what, one of our first data papers that comes out needs to be on obstetric violence, because there's nothing from Australia that says that we have obstetric violence here. We use different terms. We use birth trauma. We'll lump it in with birth trauma. And absolutely, women that have obstetric violence experience birth trauma. But birth trauma covers so many other things. And obstetric violence can get lost in there. And I thought, you know what, there are other countries that do this so well. Seven out of the 11 countries in South America have a law against obstetric violence. And we don't. In fact, it's not even recognised in our violence against women and children government document that's been out for tender. Like, it's
That's also a reflection on our current, I suppose, current government's views, and but within our society when we're looking at domestic violence in general, kind of any violence towards women, it's still seen, and so frightening that we're supposedly a developed country, but we still, women are still treated as though they're not first-class citizens.
Well, there's also a lot of, I think, that developed or high-income country viewpoint.
Yeah.
As in, sure, we'll publish the work that's been done in the low-income countries because they have obstetric violence there.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen here.
We don't have it here.
Yeah.
And I think it's such a colonialist view.
Oh, it is.
And
it is.
It just, the more I read and the stuff coming out of South America and Africa, like, it's really powerful stuff, and India. But to say that it's not happening here or in the UK or in any other
country.
But
we hear it. We hear it with the stories that the women tell us.
We know it's there.
And go, yep, so that's, and whether it's a midwife, whether it's a medical, whether it's a porter, whether it's domestic staff, you can hear it all the time. And that,
But we don't want to admit it.
No.
And I don't know if our colleges want to admit it. I don't know if our professions want to admit it. So, that's the first big paper I wrote. I did a content analysis on the over 600 comments that were written about obstetric violence.
Yeah.
That was my January. I wrote it in a month. And it was hard to write. Like, it would take me to, you know, quite difficult places. My husband did the content analysis, and seriously, like, you know, he's one of the biggest midwifery feminists out there now. You know, he would have to get up and just walk away.
Well, that's one of the questions that I wanted to ask is, and I ask everyone this, that there are moments, quite often moments within doing your PhD pathway, where you either do or feel like rocking in the corner, that whatever you're reading, either it's the stress of everything or the content, in, especially within your case, how do you balance that? How do you maintain that sanity?
I think I keep in my core that there's a woman at the end of that comment who has volunteered her time to do this survey and then has allowed us to rip open her wound.
Yeah.
And then she has shared that. She's bled into that survey, her story.
Yeah.
And then she's just patched it up as best as she can and moved on with her life. And I have to honour that, because that would have been so painful. I never write these difficult questions lightly. I'm not going to write a difficult question like that and then just ignore the data. And I know that was the hardest one to answer. So that was the first one that I answered. That's the first one I'm reporting on. And it's not to annoy our colleges or to annoy our different professions out there. It's to honour the woman that ripped open that wound and bled into my survey. And then we had to patch it. And then she had to patch it back up. Yes, we gave her helplines, but she patched it back up and carried on with her life. And there was over 626 comments. Of all of those would have been women that shared that story. So they deserved a voice. And that's what I always keep on, is that this woman deserves a voice. And I can't put all 626 comments in the paper, but each one of those becomes part of one of the categories.
Yeah.
and gives us the bigger picture. And as, with a content analysis, you see the numbers.
Yeah.
So it's a bit different from a thematic. You see the numbers and the frequency of comments that are in one. So we can even say, what is the biggest area? And what is the most big, what's the biggest subcategory and all that kind of stuff. It's good. It's a hard paper to read. It's powerful. And the comments, you know, they are powerful comments. And they talk about assaults. And I think we really have a very fine line between sexual assault and vaginal and routine vaginal examinations. And this paper shows you that.
Yeah. Reading that.
It's full on. It's under review. So
good.
Hopefully that gets out there. It needs to get out there. We want to get it out there. And we've got the stats stuff. We're going to look at the stats stuff about what kind of, you know, increases obstetric violence or risks of birth trauma. We'll do all that stuff. But this one was deeply personal to write. And it only had myself, Warren and Hannah on it because, you know, this was one that we really needed to just kind of focus in on. We worked very hard on it because we need to open that conversation now. You know, we need to say, yes, it's here. So what can we do about it?
You can't fix the system unless you have transparency.
Exactly. And we want ownership.
Yeah.
We want people to say, and even, you know, individuals to think, everything they're doing, have a pause and go, am I potentially being violent in this situation?
Yeah.
Is there elements to what I'm about to do that could be seen as violent to that woman? And sometimes we say, oh, you know, we really need to think about just women who've had a previous sexual assault. Mm. But actually, this is all women.
Yeah.
And to be fair, pretty much all women have experienced some kind of violence in their life.
Yes.
And whether that is an inappropriate word, a term, an inappropriate touching, all the way through to intimate partner violence and death, you know, it is there. And maternity is not a safe place for our women to be if we know 1 in 10 women experience violence.
Exactly. And there's so much, when you think of the word violence, we're automatically thinking about the physical contact of it. We're thinking about the higher end. We're not necessarily remembering that it can be the way that we speak. It can be the way that things are done. There are multiple different levels of violence, the way it can be done, which is why assault and battery were two different things, because assault mm-hmm. was the perception that you're going to get hit and battery was the physical being hit.
Yeah.
And they kind of broke it down to just assault now, because you don't need to separate them out too, mm-hmm. because you still have the effect with that kind of the verbalness that's kind of going through.
We saw that in the analysis. You know, there were three main categories, which was I felt dehumanized.
Yep.
I felt violated.
Yep.
And I felt powerless.
Yep.
And the physical stuff was all in violated. And there's some real physical stuff in there. It's not just vaginas and vulvas that were assaulted. There were other parts of the body as well.
Mm.
By a variety of health professionals. I hate to say it, midwives were not immune.
No. Across the board.
It is. And I don't want to demonize people. I often think some people don't even realize what they are that they're what they're doing. But then I read some of the comments and I'm like, how could that person be doing that? From that woman's perspective, I don't see how it could be much different from the person who's doing it. So, yeah, there's definitely the physical side of it. There's a whole category. The biggest subcategory of them all was in that one.
Yeah.
But there's the rest of it. It's the powerlessness and it's the dehumanizing. And I think it's actually a process that the abusers, and it's a horrible term to use, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking about our brothers and sisters in midwifery and in obstetrics and in other professions. I think there's a process that goes through that. I think you have to make the woman feel powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And then you dehumanize her, and then it means that you are then open to violating her. And it's a bit of a process, which is why those three categories I think were so important.
Mm.
They stand alone, but I also think they make part of the bigger picture in being able to be to the point that you can violate someone. So, yeah, that's a pretty powerful one. I'm apprehensive about it coming out, but, you know, there's going to be quite interesting feedback from it. And kickback from it. But, you know, going back to what you were saying about how do you look after yourself in that is even with any kickback that we get, I know I am being true to the woman that bled into my survey.
Yep. And you have to be, because otherwise women are not going to be involved in the future if they think that they're not actually being kind of respected. Yeah. And we can't, you have to take the seal off, you have to take the lid off to be able to show that transparency and put the light in before we can actually change. We need to know what to change.
Yeah. And we will look at what works. We will look at, the statistics will show us. We'll look at models of care, and we will look at things that protect women to not experience that and those that did experience it. So we can already see some trends that we did just while we were writing that paper, but we're going to really look into that. So we will also then have some ideas on how to make it better.
On to a nicer kind of thought, or a more positive thought, shall we say, just as we're kind of wrapping up, because I'm very aware of the time and you're graciously giving me. How did you celebrate your PhD?
Well...
Or have you yet?
Yeah, I kind of have. Like, when I finished my master's, I went to Japan for the ICM regional conference. That was my celebration.
Oh, fabulous.
And then my husband and stepdaughter came out and joined me, and we had a bit of a holiday together. So I was assuming I would be doing that, but then obviously it was COVID land. So we did go for a very short holiday, but it was tricky. It was too close to an operation my husband had, so he wasn't the most well. I probably, in hindsight, should have delayed that.
Yeah.
But probably the best thing that happened was my beautiful team at Western came up to the Blue Mountains and took me to the Hydro Majestic. So if you don't know,
oh, that's a stunning place. Uh-huh.
The Hydro Majestic is this beautiful hotel that was closed for many years but has been reopened, and it's right on the edge of the cliff overlooking the Megalong Valley. And it's a very...
it's like mid-1800s.
It's got an amazing history. Oh, amazing gorgeous. History. And they do afternoon... They have a beautiful, like, big grand hall, and they do afternoon teas, like very posh afternoon teas.
Stunning.
So, yeah, and it's one of... I'm going to say it's one of Hannah's favourite places. We've been there a few times. But they took me out for my graduation. So pretty much everyone in the team turned up, came up from Sydney. I only had to travel 5 minutes, which is very lucky. But everyone else travelled up, and they took me there and got me some gifts and made me feel so special. So, yeah, that was my biggest thing. I couldn't get an overseas trip, but I would exchange that for what I had that day. Yep. It was just amazing. I felt on cloud nine at the end of it, and was able to thank everyone because, I was working full-time while doing my PhD. So everyone was part of that journey. I've got an amazing supervisor and colleague, Fiona, who is really supportive of everything that I've done. So to have them all there, not just my supervisors but the actual whole team, that was probably the best thing I've had.
And on the last night, you made a comment that you were not necessarily the smartest in your family to kind of like with education. And I've been talking to a lot of potential students that want to do postgraduate studies in the last kind of week or two. And it's the thing that keeps coming back to me when I'm talking to a variety of different potential students or people who are interested is, I'm not smart enough to do a PhD. I'm not smart enough to do postgraduate studies. Like, we know that that's just kind of ridiculous thinking, but what do you say to the people that you talk to who make those same comments that have an interest to explore but put these barriers and blinkers on themselves?
Well, first of all, from having my master's and then my PhD, I now know I'm not the idiot in the family.
Yep.
And I'm the only one in my family with a PhD. And it has finally helped me reconcile what I was like as a child. And I can now look back and say it wasn't my level of intelligence. It was the educational system that was at fault. I most likely have ADHD when I look at, how I am and how my daughter is. And I probably am going to go through the testing for that just to really know. But I wouldn't see that as a negative. I'd see it as the fact that I can do so much and I have so much energy. And I have just got more understanding about myself.
Mm.
But the other thing I would say is that it's a training program. Mm. You started your midwifery not knowing that you could be a midwife at the end of it, but you became a midwife at the end of it. And all throughout any university program, you're learning a skill, and writing is just one of those skills. If I looked at how I wrote at the beginning of my master's to how I write now, they would be hugely different. I'm still the same person.
Mm.
But a research degree is a morphing of you into a researcher. And a lot of our programs now have really good training.
Yeah.
We've got a Masters of Research here at Western, which hands down is the best research training you could get. They learn so much, and they have so many little things that they do beforehand. It's really good theory, and then they get to go and do their own course. We have a really good honours program that does the same type of thing. You've got some really good ground level stuff first, and then you move on to do your project.
Yeah.
Even when you're doing your project, everything you write isn't just you writing and sending it off to the examiner and then you're getting a mark. It goes to your supervisors. Your supervisors do stuff, and then it comes back to you, and then you do stuff, and then it goes back. It's like a game of tennis, but you never actually know who won at the end.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I like that.
Because you can look at a sentence at the end of, you know, the paper that goes in, and especially when you're doing your PhD, not really know who came up with the actual sentence that was there. I mean, it's important to look at your track changes, see how your supervisors change the content, and then just purely by a process of osmosis, you start doing that.
Yep.
And it's a really strange journey. Like, I honestly can't say I did a formal writing course or, I know how things have changed. I can remember a lot of my supervisors' comments, like, I tend to write sentences backwards. You know, I'd have...
Okay.
And I had to keep flipping them over, and that's just about the content. I know from my editor from my master's that I used the term that, or the word that, a lot.
Mine was this.
So I then learned to refine my sentences based on the feedback I received.
Yep.
So it's changed, but it's not to do with intelligence.
Mm.
Research is all about passion.
Yep.
And I constantly get told I have a lot of passion, and that's true, I do. But it's about that passion. And if you've got a question that you want answering and you are passionate about finding that answer, then you are already a researcher.
Yeah.
And everyone uses the term research now, don't they? They say, oh, I went onto Google and I researched this. So actually it's something that we do. If we have a question, we want to get it answered, mm-hmm. and we know how to find the answer. The difference in research is you're doing it in a methodical way that then gets out and answers the question for so many more people, so that when they have that question, they're actually going to you for the answer.
Exactly.
And that's something that is very, very exciting. And when I get women contact me on my Facebook page who are planning a VBAC, or midwives or doulas, and they're like, Hazel, what about this and what about that? I know they're actually coming to me, and I actually had those questions to begin with, but now they're coming to me for answers. And that's the power of research, because you read so much about this topic, learn so much about the topic, and then you explore it in depth. You become an expert. And it's not about intelligence. It's just about having a want to answer a question and then the determination to get to the end.
Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.